Welcome to Historias, the podcast from the Southeastern Council on Latin American Studies. I'm your host, Dustin Walcher, joined by my partner, Stephen Hyland. 2 days ago, at the time of this recording, Bolivian President Evo Morales resigned after sustained opposition demonstrations that followed his apparent re-election to the presidency. By all accounts, the military forced this move, and Morales is, again, at the time of this recording, en route to exile in Mexico. Joining us to begin to make sense of these developments are Drs. Thomas Field and Carmen Solis. Dr. Field is Associate Professor of Global Security and Intelligence at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and Dr. Solis is Assistant Professor of History at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Thomas, Carmen, thank you for coming on the program, and welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thomas, if I may begin with you, could you give us sort of a sit rep of where we are right now in regards to Bolivia?
Well, sure. I mean, I'll actually pick up right where you left off, Stephen. The issue of sustained protest over the last few weeks since the October 20th election is really nothing new for Bolivia. Bolivia is no stranger to political protest. What's interesting about what's happened over the past couple of days is not the size of protests, which in many cases was quite a bit smaller than before. But really, the police mutiny, I think, was the linchpin for the sort of catalyst for everything that occurred afterward. And the police that rose up and declared themselves on the side of the anti-government protesters was the precise police units, basically the tactical units, the SWAT teams, the anti-riot police that had for 15 years sort of been the guards of the presidential areas, the presidential palaces, the ministries. So their uprising, their revolt was actually quite striking. Now, obviously, at that point, it put a lot of government officials in harm's way. A lot of them sort of began to hide out. The military then announced that they would not confront police or protesters and asked the president to resign. So we really don't have a government right now. In Bolivia, the mass party has been repressed fiercely. Houses burned. Many have gone into exile. The moderates in the opposition, so I want to be fair to those in the opposition that didn't want a full-scale coup d'etat, they've been asking for the opposition, so the forces of security to stop repressing the former governing party so that they can maintain a constitutional succession. But they're not going to have much cooperation from the ousted mass party at this point. So I don't see much hope for a constitutional selection. The opposition party has been trying to show up at the parliament to vote in a sort of successor government. But it looks to me like the de facto situation, which is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces is in charge of the country right now, it's probably sort of what we're faced with. And that's frustrating, obviously, for the moderates in the opposition, and it's devastating for those who supported the previous government.
At this point, do we have any sense of why these particular police units, why some of the military high command would move into opposition and would make this move against the government, right? In terms of the timing, the ideology, why now? Why did this happen?
I mean, I can't get inside their heads. I know that, it's a tall order. Anytime you ask police to confront protesters. I mean, I think that there's been a lot of unrest. There's been three mutinies of the police in the past 15 years, usually connected with salaries. The police chiefs yesterday or the day before yesterday came out immediately and said, no, this mutiny is really about, working conditions. And this is just a strike, basically. But the rebel police officers, the sort of heads of the tactical units and SWAT teams, came out very clearly with the tricolor flag. We are with, people, as they called it, basically with the protesters. I mean, my guess is that there's, people who have studied the sort of sociological makeup of certain police units. And I think that there's just some sympathies between some of the more extreme right wing opposition forces and some of the SWAT team leaders. I mean, I think Camacho, the southern sort of Eastern leader of the coup, sort of catalyst in the past couple of days. I think that his sort of brave sort of action, his sort of Christian nationalistic actions, have really inspired some of the more radical factions to rise up. So it's something that no one really expected. I think most of the police units were sort of neutral in the whole thing. But this one sort of unit, and then they put Camacho on top of their tanks and sort of paraded him through the streets Sunday night, you know, and so it was very much the civil political coup that we witnessed here between, I'm sorry, civilian and police coup that we witnessed over the past few days.
Yeah. So what I would like to add that for me, there were some symbolic elements of what happened in the last 3 days that to some degree are mirroring or are kind of thinking in what happened in 2002 and 2003. And what happened in 2003 when protesters were against Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada, that was the moment in which Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada called the army and called the police to repress the population. And we had about 100 people that died in El Alto in that event. So I think it was very, very strong in not only in the government's conscience, but also in the army and in the police, that feeling that we are not going to go to the streets to repress. And it was, I think we, for me, so many of the things were happening in 3 days ago, where we all have in our kind of political consciousness what happened in 2003. So on the one hand, the government was very strong about saying, no, we're not going to take the army to repress the people. Mm-hmm. And I think that they were mainly thinking in what happened in 2003 when members of the government started to resign. That was also something that happened in 2003. So I think they were trying, both the police, the army, the government, they were trying to act in a way that will, it won't mirror what happened in 2003.
Is there any indication that Evo asked these tactical units to forcibly repress any of the events taking place in the streets?
Well, that's their job, frankly. I mean, I think that their job is to protect the presidential palace. And so, you know, the fact that they, when the protest began to come up, I don't know the exact details. We've got to work through this in the next few weeks and years, really, to figure out what happened in this coup d'etat. But when the protesters marched toward the plaza, the tactical units are supposed to block the plaza. Whenever there's demonstrations in La Paz, the tactical units essentially set up roadblocks around the entire sort of, well, you've seen it in Mexico City, you've seen it in, well, Washington, D.C., for that matter, and to have a sort of cordon sanitaire around the government building. So the fact that they came out, and they didn't just say, we're not going to repress these these protesters, but they actually began to march with them through the area. I mean, the president had to flee, and the head sort of instigator of all this, Luis Fernando Camacho, the Santa Cruz leader, you know, marched in with police into the presidential palace with a Bible and a tricolor flag and said, you know, Christianity's finally been brought back to Bolivia. So there is lots of symbolism here. I want to just quickly mention, in terms of Carmen, I really hope that Carmen is right. I really hope that the police and the army just didn't want to repress civilians. And that's why they said, we're not going to come out and put down the sort of right wing sort of protests. But what we've seen over the past 48 hours is that even though the hierarchies of the police and the military have tried to downplay what's happening, many rebel units have been going after mass figures. There have been houses burned. There have been people are very afraid for their lives and their families because there have been violence carried out, not just by vigilantes on the far right, but also by rebel police units working with them. So I hope that Carmen's right. I hope that the police and military are coming out to say, you know, let's say they're just going to establish order. But I fear that what's really happening is what Luis Fernando Camacho wants, which is a sort of purging of the mass party from Bolivia's politics and a sort of restoration of the status quo ante.
Well, I see the danger, and I'm really afraid with the picture that you are portraying. At the same time, I think we need the course of events have been very chaotic, and I think there were very key elements of violence that we've seen in the last 3 days, and some of them were led by mass supporters. I think one of the things that happened, they put on fire the house of Waldo Albarracín, who was a very key figure in Bolivia. He was the ombudsman, now president of the university, and he was one of the leading forces, one of the forces against Evo Morales. They put on fire the house of Casimira Lema, another journalist. And I think they also threatened Galarza, who was a journalist in the university TV. and she was questioning the role of the government. And yesterday, there were very weird images in which people of En El Alto was chanting "Ahora sí, guerra civil," which is now yes, let's go for a civil war. So I think there were elements that were very troubling in the last 3 days, and it's going to be very hard to unpack. I think we need to unpack that, and we need probably a couple of years to unpack what happened.
It's very scary. I agree with Carmen, and the attacks on the rector of the main university are tragic. I mean, but of course that followed the burning of the president's house, the Evo Morales' exactly. sister's house. I mean, I think that, you know, to blame the MAS party for what's happening now, I think is to blame the victim of this coup. And yes, there are MAS sort of resistance out there who are going to be carrying out whatever they can carry out to try to stop the overthrow of their government. But at this point, and that's precisely why the police and military will be coming out and I think eventually repressing the MAS, because the MAS is the only resistance to what occurred. And so, I mean, I agree that this is terribly sad what's happening. And I think that it just fuels, I think, both of our fears that what we see here is turning into essentially a sort of textbook coup d'etat. The commander in chief of the armed forces is de facto in charge of the country right now. All that's left is for a junta to be formed or some sort of declaration to be made, because the constitutional order has clearly been broken.
I disagree with some of the things that you said, Thomas, because I think that there was a sense, in the sense that I think to portray Evo Morales as a victim. And I think there are elements that I totally agree with you, that this is a moment in which it was a popular protest, and right-wing forces are kind of seizing from this moment and capitalizing from this moment. And I'm really afraid about that. At the same time, when I was listening at the last speech of Evo Morales when he was resigning, I saw no self-criticism. And I think there were a lot of elements that helped explain why people in Bolivia was so upset for such a long time against Evo Morales. So I'd like to recap a little bit, if it's possible, what I see these elements of abuse of power, and that's that he had been collecting for a number of years in his government. I will say that one of them was, it goes back to 2011, to the case of Tiffany's, when Evo Morales stubbornly was trying to build this highway across this indigenous park, and indigenous groups from the lowlands who were living in the park were against this project, and there was a massive struggle there. Probably this was one of the first moments in which many people start criticizing Evo Morales. Is he really this environmentalist, this leader that is taking care of Mother Earth, except some things like that? A second moment that I would say that was critical, and in this feeling that he was not who was he was portraying to be, was the case of Zapata, that I think you were mentioning. You were talking about that last week in your last interview about Bolivia, Thomas. This was the case in which it was a little bit of like a soap opera, but he was dating this woman, Gabriela Zapata, and this woman was working for a Chinese company, and because of that personal relation, this company was able to secure business with a number of offices in the state. And so until that moment, I think there many people had like some complaints about cases of corruption here and there. But until that moment, Evo Morales had such a strong stance of that he was almost impeccable in terms of his there were no cases of corruption that you could refer about until that moment. Another key case that was well spread everywhere was the case of Nemesia Chacoyo, who's Ministry of the Rural Development or something like that. And there was some deviation of public funding from funds that were destined to indigenous people, from Fondo Indígena to their personal accounts. And I will say that the last thing that I would like to mention was the what happened in terms of the fire that happened in August, that the fires that started in the Amazon on the Brazilian side and on the Bolivian side. And people there, especially people from Santa Cruz, was very upset to the government because the government responded very slow to what was happening. But mainly, many people say, well, the government has been, although they have been talking about protecting the Mother Earth and protecting the Amazon, protecting the air, the government, Evo Morales' government, has been massively expanding the agricultural frontier in that area. So for me, I think there was people was angry at this kind of duplicity in his speech in a number of levels. So the last thing I would like to point out is that for many Bolivians, I felt that there was a sense that he was a little bit of kind of shameless to talk about the coup and to say that there was some illegal actions coming from the opposition, because he has been irreverent to the law that he himself approved. He approved the constitution, and the constitution clearly says that he could not be a candidate anymore. Then he called for a referendum to be a candidate. That was 2016. He lost his own referendum, and no matter what, he ran for elections.
So, not no matter what. I mean, there was a Supreme Court decision. It wasn't just no matter what. I mean, the Supreme Court is the highest law of the land, Carmen.
You know that he lost the referendum. It was already illegal to call the referendum, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think I'm not saying
a constitutional referendum. I don't think it's illegal to ask the people to vote. Let me just because you mentioned a lot of things that I think are essentially talking points for the campaign of the opposition before the election, which I think helps to explain why the MAS party only got 47% instead of 53 in 2015, which was actually after the Tipni struggle. So, I mean, Evo Morales is still the most popular politician, single politician in the country. The MAS party is still the most popular party in the country. So all the things you described just helps to describe sort of why the opposition is so upset, why the country's so divided, and why the MAS party lost support from last time. But it still doesn't describe sort of any sort of majoritarian movement in Bolivia for MAS's ouster, nor does it justify a constitutional break, which is essentially what we've experienced here because of the actions of Camacho and the police. So, I think that it's sort of just because you criticize the government does not justify a coup, essentially, is what I'd like to make sure we clarify.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying, but I'm trying to explain that if we only focus on Camacho and I agree, it's scared right wing people. We don't understand what there were so many people protesting and for about 20 years before the resignation. The other thing that I pointed to basically to those elements of abuse of power, and I would like to point to a couple of other things that I think for me also are very important to understand what happened. On the one hand, I will say that and Thomas, you said that this in the last program, you mentioned some of the achievements of the government in terms of reduction of poverty. That's absolutely undeniable in terms of closing the gap in terms of inequality. But I will say that the sectors that mainly benefit from Evo Morales' government were the most marginalized rural sectors in Bolivia. I think there is an economic clash, and that's why the society is so divided. I was listening to, I think it was Cesut Sebe leader yesterday saying, like, we won't let power go. Cesut Sebe is the largest peasant confederation in Bolivia. And there is a feeling that if Evo leaves, these sectors that have clearly benefited from the presence of Evo Morales in the government are going to lose influence and are going to lose power. So the sectors that I will say did not benefit as much with Evo Morales, and that's part that the group of people that I see protesting in the streets was kind of this middle urban class. That for them, having Evo Morales did not change as much as it was the case with this rural support that's very strong for Evo, and probably
we can agree on that. I think.
And the last thing I will say that I'll start with one story. In the UN led a report about Bolivia in 2005. I think it was 2005, and it was a survey, and they were asking Bolivia, do you think an indigenous could be president? This was 2005, and the majority of the people say no, we're not ready yet. So I think for sure the, having Evo Morales in power was to some degree irreverent and really powerful and defiant to a still really racist society. So I think those racisms and angers are being latent in the last since Evo came to power. So I the problem for me is that it's very hard to unpack. I think all of those elements, very this anti-democratic elements, racist elements, the anger of the middle classes, plus this the all four things that I said I listed in terms of abuse of power were there.
What does the composition of the opposition look like? Right, this has been a really good discussion of how we got to this point of the political background, but could you help tease out the various component parts of the opposition that's moving against Morales?
I've studied coups most of my life, and one thing that fascinates me about coups and insurrections and revolutions are the incredible diversity of groups within the opposition forces. Almost always, it's I was talking with someone yesterday about this, and you know, it's sort of claiming that this insurrection, this coup, had many authors, had many fathers, and that's absolutely true. And because without every single sort of puzzle piece, I don't think that this would have happened. Like, I don't think that, you know, Mesa served a certain purpose in this. The election and the OAS served a certain, you know, role. Camacho was a very important catalyst. The police mutiny was enormous. The statement by the dissident Peasant Federation leader, the expelled Peasant Federation leader, was huge. The Kobe statement was fascinatingly complex, and I think we'll be studying that for years. You know, and on and on and on. Sort of the Potosi march in, the sort of reports that are sort of still unverified about different horrible things that happened to the protesters coming in from Potosi. So all of these different groups have certainly played a role. And if you want to think in terms of historical antecedents, you know, every single coup and insurrection and revolution in Bolivia has been essentially a contested matter, like from the very first day it happened. Like, is it a coup? Is it a revolution? Is it an insurrection? You know, the ones that I've studied have included coalitions between sort of right-wing phalangists and Communist Party members and Trotskyists sometimes, Maoist, anarchists. You know, the peasants sometimes join in, the workers don't.
This seems like the definition of a diverse coalition.
It is quite diverse. I mean, yesterday or the day before yesterday, you essentially had, you know, sort of this middle class, I think what Carmen was describing as sort of the disenfranchised middle class who now sort of have not necessarily seen their wages go up a tremendous amount, but yet their employees' wages have. And so it kind of has put a stress on that sort of disenfranchised middle class. So that group, you know, a lot of them voting for Mesa, but then a lot of other opposition figures putting their hope in Mesa. You know, those are sort of the liberal opposition that we sort of think about when we talk about, oh, well, human rights and authoritarianism. That's the sort of discourse they're using. There's also the anti-mass left, which I think Carmen is also, I think, implicitly referring to as well with the Titney struggle. You know, the anarchist left or some greens have been sort of against masses extractivism. Obviously, the phalangist sort of resurgence from the right wing sort of Catholic Hispanic Santa Cruz faction. There have always been a lot of Trots that have, you know, Trotsky is sort of ultra leftist in the COB who have not been in charge of the COB, but have been sort of pushing the COB to more radical positions. I mean, we could look at all these different factions, but what they all have in common is that they all came to agree that the mass had to go. But I will just stress once more that that's not a majoritarian faction. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't be heard, but they never did get to the point where they could defeat mass in the ballot box, which is why we're at where we're at right now.
I will say that one of the groups that has been against Evo after Tivnis especially was the indigenous groups of the lowlands. So we tend to think that in Bolivia, especially foreigners, when they think in Bolivia an indigenous movement, we tend to think in a very unified and kind of homogeneous movement. And I think indigenous movement of the lowlands lost a lot under Evo Morales. They actually won more under the neoliberal government when they were granted collective territories, the so-called TCOs, and ABLE has been massively encouraging the migration of people from the highlands to the lowlands, and some of the groups who were losing were these landowners, these businessmen, and also the indigenous groups of the lowlands who were losing land to the migrants. Then I will also point out the coca growers. He had clearly supported the coca growers in Chapare, in Cochabamba, which is the region where he's coming from. And that was somehow in detriment of the coca growers of Yungas, which is the traditional area of production of coca. So in terms, I see a couple, those are political complaints, but also economic complaints on both groups. I will also like to highlight the opposition coming from the feminist movement. I think the role of Maria Galindo coming from this group called Mujeres Creandos, is a feminist group, has been another important voice in the conflict. I think probably she was one of the most clear voices in which she will argue that it is a trap to some degree to think that there is a struggle between the left and the right, because ABLE was not in the left anymore for a long time. That to some degree, the way in which handling the government somehow betray a lot of the things that the left had embraced. So I don't know if you, Thomas, want to.
No, I agree completely about the first. Yeah, I mean, I meant to, you know, when I said the dissident indigenous, dissident peasant groups, I was sort of thinking in terms as well of the lowland, the Tiffany's movements. And I also mentioned the sort of green opposition to Evo, which also was sort of wrapped up within the Tiffany's movement. In terms of the Mujeres Creando, the group led by Maria Galindo, I mean, you're absolutely right. She's been a critic of the mass government for quite some time, but she's also come out very strongly now against what she calls a military coup. So, I mean, you know, it's important, I think, at this point, there's lots of criticism that we can wage on each other's sort of political projects within a constitutional order. But I think at this point, I think we have to recognize that whatever just, I guess, complaints that different individuals and groups had about masses' economic policies, its extractivist policies, this is not a coup that is going to lead to a society that's better for women or better for the environment or better for workers or better for peasants. And we're not seeing the development of a liberatory revolutionary sort of constitutional break, but something else. Now, obviously, we don't know how this is all going to play out. I mean, it could be that some other leader comes up in the next 48 hours. There really is no government in Bolivia. So I'm just saying what I think is going to happen based on the past in Bolivia. And when left-wing movements joined in with coup movements, like in 64, like in 71, we saw, you know, a lot of the peasant movements, especially the indigenous movements, were sort of agitating against Torres in 71. A lot of the Trotskyists in the mines, and eventually communists and Maoists in the mines, were agitating against Paz Estenssoro in 64. None of them ended up being happy with the result. Like, none of them ended up, you know, happy with like the military coup that came afterwards. So I hope that that's not what we're seeing here, but I fear that, and I know that you share some of those fears, that may be what is happening over the next.
I have to say that I have to agree with you in everything that you said, because I think this reminds me, I was thinking this morning that this reminded me a lot to 64, in which you kind of have a sense of exhaustion of the government after 10 years, after 12 years in power. But what is coming, I don't think it's necessarily much better. That I totally will agree with you.
Yeah. I mean, there's some really fabulous, like, if you want to think in terms of from the historical perspective, if you really enjoy studying these differences, there's some fascinating similarities. In fact, the protesters that I mentioned before coming from Potosí and like up into La Paz to join Camacho and the police in the Plaza San Francisco, they got stopped by government loyalists. They apparently were treated very badly, maybe even abused, sexually abused. There's some horrible allegations. I'm not sure what the truth is there yet, but the same exact sort of dynamic occurred when the miners were marching in 64. The sort of massacre, or the massacre of Sora, never really happened. I mean, sort of there was some confrontation. So, I mean, a lot of it was almost eerie, the similarities between 2019 and 1964.
I just want to timestamp us. The BBC is now reporting that former President Evo Morales has safely landed in Mexico. with him out of the way, and with this unclear power dynamic that's currently happening, I mean, who are some of the key players we need to be keeping our eye on? You mentioned the commander of the Bolivian army. I believe that the next in line is a senator. Constitutionally, next in line, the last man standing, if you will, is a opposition senator.
Not exactly. I mean, the opposition signature, she's basically the minority leader. So if the mass party doesn't show up, but there's still a quorum, the understanding is that she would be elected. You know, so if Nancy Pelosi were to resign and 50 Democrats were to resign from the House, then the Republicans could then elect their leader as the new president. That's sort of what's going on. I believe. Is that right? Is that right, Carmen?
Yeah.
I believe that.
No. Yeah. I think that's correct. That's correct. I think to see what happened this afternoon, right? I think she was calling for Congress to meet at this afternoon. So we need to wait what happened.
Well, yeah, she and Mesa's party are sort of begging, not just they're begging the mass party to like come out of hiding essentially, and show up to cast a vote so that then it can remain a constitutional transition. But I think that given what's happened over the last 40 hours, whether mass party officials are legitimately afraid or not, I think they are. They do have legitimate reasons to be afraid. I don't think they have any motivation to participate in so what they would see, I think justifiably to some extent, as essentially an attempt to make the coup not look like a coup.
So if you're advising Moss, what do you advise them?
If I were advising Moss, they haven't paid me very well lately. So I'm just obviously kidding. Yeah, I mean, honestly, if I were a political party that was just overthrown in sort of a violent, houses were burned down, I would probably, well, it's hard to say. I don't want to give advice to the mass. They're going through enough now without some gringo in Arizona giving them advice. I wish them all very well. And I hope that they're all safe. And I hope that Bolivia can return to constitutionality as soon as possible.
I think, of course, that one of the things that it was quite clear that as we already discussed, many sectors wanted Evo or were upset for whatever and whatever we end up in the situation where we are. But I think I'm sure now it's going to be a lot more clear that the disputes within this movement are going to appear a lot more clear. So I don't see, for example, a Waldo Albarracín agreeing with Camacho. Or Mujeres Creando with this right wing sectors in Santa Cruz. So I think we're going to see a lot of chaos.
So can Carlos Mesa be that statesman figure that can act as the midwife, not only to the next election, but my presumption is he's the only one with national standing that could win it. Am I seeing that right?
Only if Evo is not allowed to run, which is why that's been his main condition the whole time. His main condition has been that Evo Morales should call elections in which he can't run or the vice president. So, I mean, he might be able to win an election if Evo is prohibited from running. I don't know. What do you think, Carmen? I mean, I think that he could probably run for election, but he's not the kind of guy that's inspiring people to go and risk their lives in the streets right now. Like, he's kind of seen as like more of a father figure than like a revolutionary or, I don't know, someone who inspires action in the streets, which in this moment, that's really what matters.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I clearly after all the protests were happening, the person who sees the screen was Camacho, and you were wondering what happened with Carlos Mesa, and Thomas was mentioning last week that he is a historian, and I don't think he is very good at rallying people around him. Hopefully,
Mesa,
exactly. I hope he can be what Steve is saying, the person who can probably get this through. But I don't know. I have a question that we were discussing this with Steve before the interview. And it's a question for Thomas. So why do you think the mass did not name a successor? And I think if you were in Bolivia for the last year, there were many events, I remember public events in which Javier Albo, for example, who's a writer, a very famous figure in Bolivia, long ago told to Evo Morales, you can come back in 2024 and you can, like, as the most famous figure and you can come, you can be a president again in 2024. Just go. Why don't you, why did they didn't name a successor and kind of go with the referendum, no matter what, I think, which was part of why people was upset. So I don't know if you have thoughts about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was only in the country for, you know, a few weeks, this year. And then, before that, it was a while before I was really there for a long period of time. And last time I was there for a long period of time, there was a lot of discussion about that, about maybe having someone run for president and like letting Evo Morales be vice president, kind of like what Putin hit on in Russia with the Medvedev period. You know, I really don't know enough about the sort of internal mass dynamics to speculate on why. But I think that over the past 15 years, we've noticed that. I mean, could you name? I guess I'll put it back. Could you name a figure? You know, who could inspire sort of this coalition? Because the mass is also a very diverse coalition. I mean, it's a coalition of indigenistas, some moderate indigenistas, many socialists, some on the far left, but not the furthest of left, some middle class socialists, a few progressive liberals, maybe even. I mean, so how do you keep all that together? I don't know if there was another candidate. I think they just determined that there wasn't someone else who could inspire that unity over the long period of time. And I think it's also important, and I think you understand this quite well, about political party politics, that, you know, I don't think that Evo Morales sort of was calling all the shots right here, right? It's sort of the mass party and the hierarchy, like, almost thrust him, you know, back to do it again. I think that this is, again, very much speculation, but if you look at the resignations a couple of days ago, Evo Morales looks, I mean, pretty tired. I mean, I think that he's been through a lot. I think that Alvaro Garcia, the vice president, the ex-vice president now, seems to be much more fired up and ready to start back the struggle to return. I think he took some Bolivian land away. I don't know if you saw this. He says, I will be back soon to put this land back where it belongs. He's talked about going back to the guerrilla struggle, which is where he began, right? He began as a guerrilla in the 1990s, you know, fighting in a revolution, you know, an armed revolutionary way against the government. So I don't know. I don't know if there was a leader, though, that could really electorally maintain the coalition like Evo Morales. That's the best I can do.
I have a theory, and I don't know, what do you think about this? Well, one of the things that for me, what was happening was that Evo Morales has been kind of closely following what was happening in the rest of Latin America. And mm-hmm. the idea of naming a successor, for example, Lula naming Dilma and Correa naming Lenin Moreno, that didn't work.
Absolutely.
Right? Mm-hmm. And then what happened, one ended up in jail and the other one in exile. So I think they were quite afraid of facing something very similar. I disagree absolutely. A little bit with what you said in terms of, I think there were people in this 13 years that there were some names that were dropped there. For example, and the names are escaping right now to my mind, but someone, this guy from Potosí who ended up being governor, I can't remember, and then who used to be the canciller, the minister of foreign relations.
Choquehuanca.
Some people were like, playing with the idea that that some of them could be the successor of Evo Morales, and I think he was quite efficient at eroding those possibilities. I think that I don't think he did any effort to create that succession.
I think for it to have worked electorally, it would have had to be someone unlike Choquehuanca, someone who is undoubtedly loyal to Evo Morales as a percent. I think that would be sort of, you would not be able to count many people like that. Maybe Juan Ramón Quintana or Álvaro García Linera. Would they be able, because, you know, anyone else that maybe has their own political ambitions, I think for the electoral coalition, I'm not talking about like that all of our lives should be surrounding around protecting Evo Morales. I'm saying, you know, for him to win, for the mass party to win, I think you have to maintain that coalition, which is really Evo the figure is what maintains that coalition together. Just like Perón in the, you know, for much of Argentine history, you know, maintains that coalition together. You can't just grab Choquehuanca and say, okay, keep this mass coalition at 50%. He just would not be able to maintain that type of electoral strength. And the mass party from the very beginning was going to be an electoral movement towards socialism, and they maintained that to the very end.
Luis Fernando Camacho has emerged in this discussion as a very important figure. I know that he's new to the scene. in Bolivia. Could you talk a little bit about him, talk about his role in the coup and in the political process as it's been moving forward?
Well, I know very little about him, among other things, because no one knew who was Camacho 20 days ago. 20 days ago, we had Ying, who was one of the opponents of Evo Morales. We had Mesa. We had the Ortiz, who was another of the opponents. And Camacho came out of nowhere. And he is coming from Comités Pro Santa Cruz, which is a very strong non-governmental organization in Santa Cruz. It's a combination of respectable neighbors and businessmen. And it traditionally has been known Comité Pro Santa Cruz, coming from the right, is the right wing in Bolivia. From what I know, he's a businessman, and probably his courage or his capacity of stealing the movie, what made him popular. I don't know what was going to happen to him after. He was important probably for undermining Evo's presidency in this last two or three days. I don't see him. I don't see he will get more support. I mean, he may get support in Santa Cruz, but I don't see him as a figure that will rally the people in Bolivia.
I agree with Carmen that it's almost impossible to imagine Luis Fernando Camacho winning a national election for president. But I don't think it's impossible to imagine him winning 20%, 30%. Because of the respect he's gained from even Highland sort of nationalists who have nothing really in common with Santa Cruz region. Years from now, we'll know a lot more about to what extent Luis Fernando Camacho knew that he could go to the Altiplano and meet with a few dissident indigenous leaders, that he could go to the police and meet with a few dissident police tactical units, that he could go to, that the COB, the Workers Federation, would not come out and defend Evo Morales. A lot of that sort of negotiations he did not physically do because he was not sort of allowed in La Paz by the social movements until the last day when the government actually secured his own physical safety. That was in a way, maybe a misstep on the part of the government that they allowed him to come in and essentially lead the sort of ground level coup anyway. But stepping back just a little bit, and another reason why I'm not even sure he cares about being president or anything. I think that he is very dedicated to his cause, and a lot of the Pro Santa Cruz committee, historically has been very, very committed to their cause of Christianity, of Catholicism, of, I think that what Carmen said was correct. It's like a good old boys network, kind of like a glorified Rotary Club. It's certainly not, it has no like electoral, has no electoral legitimacy whatsoever. It's, some have talked about the connections with money and sort of Santa Cruz, capitalists and Branko Marinkovic and other landowners. There is certainly some of that. There's been a lot of books written. I mean, Hernan Pruden's been studying this, Ben Dangle, others about the sort of the barons of the Orient. You know, in the 1964 coup, there was actually a very several very prominent Santa Cruz leaders, Luis Maize, Carlos Barberi, the father of the other Carlos Barberi that we know of, who's probably heading back to Bolivia now. I think he was already back in Bolivia, but he's probably going to go back on the airwaves now. And they never wanted to be president, but they did serve a role in taking down several governments. So, I mean, the Santa Cruz Committee helped to overthrow Paz and Soto in 64, Torres in 71, and they even participated in the overthrow of Garcia Mesa, who they saw in 80, I guess was 80, was 80, was 81, 81 or 82, who they saw as kind of a Highland government that was not representative of Santa Cruz values. Some have called it a neo-fascist organization. Certainly the youth Santa Cruz sometimes are a little bit more, I guess, aggressive about their Catholic nationalism and their, their sort of symbolism, which I think does go pretty far to the right. I guess you'd agree with a lot of that, Carmen. I mean, I don't want to call a group fascist when it's really a glorified Rotary Club, and it's incredibly right-wing and tied with business, and they serve this purpose of agitating against many governments that seem to be what they call communistic or too, I guess, indigenistic and not respectful enough of Bolivia's like Republican history or whatever.
I think the scary part of having Camacho in Bolivia is that he could rally support from leaders outside Bolivia. So I think Camacho in itself will be less scary if Bolsonaro was not in the region. Yeah. Or Macri will be in the region. I think after all of the things that I said up, And after all of the things that I said, that I think we need to acknowledge why people was upset in Bolivia against Evo, that we need to look at the region, and that the scary part of having a figure like Kin and a figure like Camacho would be to have the support of Bolsonaro and Macri to these right-wing movements, and Trump, which was one of the things that happened yesterday too.
And Duque in Colombia, I mean, there are various fonts of potential support. Now, this conversation has been outstanding. I greatly appreciate the two of you taking the time to walk Dustin and myself and our listeners through this. Let me ask you this. What do we need to be looking at in the coming days? What are some signals to kind of be on the lookout for in terms of the return to constitutional rule or not, a move towards elections, the sort of fraying of what was, you know, what is a heterogeneous opposition movement, but that was unified against Evo, but Evo was gone? I mean, what are you looking for?
I think we need to look to the outcome. I think we need to hear if Congress is going to say something, if Yanez is going to get some result. I think in the next 2 or 3 days, I think we are going to know something. We need to get out of this vacuum of power. We need to have a sense of if they're going to call for elections. I think that will be the key thing to look at. Probably the other thing to look at is what will be the role of the army and the police.
Yeah, I would agree with Carmen. And just to quickly follow up on something she said before. Yeah, Camacho actually went physically. It's come out that he went to Brazil to meet with Bolsonaro's one of Bolsonaro's ministers to get their support. I agree that the sort of regional forces are not necessarily aligned to stop of sort of far right shift in Bolivia. Although I think that Mexico and Argentina are moving in a direction that will maybe provide some balance at the Organization of American States. What should we be looking for in the future? I think that what Carmen described, how does the international community react? There is a sort of concerted effort. I've read it all over the news this morning, you know, Jorge Castañeda, the New York Times and Washington Post editorial boards, they've all basically, you know, The Atlantic said, you know, this is all Evo Morales' fault and he deserves what he got, essentially. And I think that there's going to be a really strong effort to legitimize what occurred, which may not age well, depending on what happens over the next year or two. There is a website, the Center for Economic Policy and Research, which I am not affiliated whatsoever, CEPR.net, which has done a statistical analysis. They're a well-known think tank, obviously left-leaning. That's not necessarily a bad thing. And they've done a statistical analysis of the elections and found essentially no irregularities, no evidence that there was any tampering. And that's going to be a really major, I think, topic of conversation in the internet, like especially in the United States. You know, did he try to rig the election or not? That's sort of become like gospel truth for a lot of the American press. And I don't think that the statistics sort of will bear out once we begin to study this over the next few years. I think that most of us will sort of come down on that side. And finally, the third thing we ought to be on the lookout for is that I think I can answer your earlier question about what I think the MAS party, not what the MAS party should do, but what they will do. I think any MAS leaders who sort of come back and participate in the election of Agnes at the parliament would probably be considered traitors by some, unless their actions are somehow coordinated with the leadership of the party or something like that. So I really don't see Agnes getting a quorum. So I guess I agree that we ought to be watching the actions of the police and the armed forces to see at what point they sort of call a spade and say, yeah, I guess we are in control. There's been a constitutional break. And I guess at that point, we should also begin to listen for the dialogue of the opposition. Are they going to call for a new constitution, right? They've already been talking about how they want to get rid of the Pachamama constitution, right? The constitution that's basically more indigenous equality with Hispanicism. And I think that those sort of rhetorical shifts we ought to pay attention to over the next few days.
I would like to thank our guests, Drs. Carmen Solis and Thomas Field, for an absolutely outstanding discussion of the fast-moving and in many ways very tragic circumstances in Bolivia. On behalf of my partner, Stephen Hyland, and the entire Historias team, I'm Dustin Walcher. Thanks for listening.